This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. This week, Elvis Costello released a new expanded double CD edition of his first record, My Aim Is True. Here's the first song from that first album from 30 years ago, Welcome to the Working Week.
Now that your picture's in the paper being graphically admired, you can have it a one that you have ever desired. All you gotta tell me now is why, why.
When Elvis Costello burst onto the pop music scene, rock critic Greil Marcus captured his essence and his individuality in a long but perfect passage. In 1977, Marcus wrote, Elvis Costello emerged in London as one of the unquestioned originals of modern pop music. Just 22 when he released his first album, My Aim Is True, he seemed master of every rock and roll move, on record and off. He combined the brains of Randy Newman and the implausibility of Bob Dylan, the everyman pathos of Buddy Holly and the uniqueness of John Lennon. Everything was up for grabs in his music. Love, money, status, hope, fear, and perhaps most of all, the very notion of control. No punk in terms of craft, he rode the punk wave because he communicated an authentic bitterness more than any punk. His demands on the world were more powerful. And thus his rejection of the world, when it failed to deliver, was more convincing. Unquote. Elvis Costello is still touring, still recording, and still very much loved by critics. Terry spoke with Elvis Costello in 1989.
When you started to perform, your manager gave you the name of Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
Elvis from Elvis Presley, Costello from your mother's maiden name.
No, it's my great-grandmother, actually.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
You see all these things, they get like changed slightly and then it gets passed on, you know?
Well, I remember being in England in 1977 and looking at one
Don't
of the...
Don't we all?
Looking at one of the magazines and seeing that great picture of you, like the one that was on the album cover of My Aim Is True, with you in the name Elvis Costello in a kind of Buddy Holly-ish pose. And it was such a striking photo. I knew I had to go hear you. And I think that's... A lot of people felt that way, even just by the photograph, that there was something happening here that was kind of interesting. Who was responsible for that pose, and how did you feel about it?
It was just a coincidence, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the happy thing about it. If it had been amazingly contrived, I think it would have been hard to sustain. I remember doing that photo session. I had two jackets at this point. That's all I had, two jackets. You know, I was trying them on, and we did some shots with this tweed jacket, and that even... Even considering I was wearing horn rims, that seemed a little bit too serious. So I put on this other jacket, it was kind of a mohair jacket, and I said, we're happening now. And I had my electric guitar, which we didn't have plugged in, so that immediately makes it kind of comical. And I think all I remember is the photographer, Keith Morris, and my manager, both of them guzzling bottles of cider, which was our chosen drink because it was very cheap. Sort of all going, go on, throw the funny legs, you know, do some of those rock and roll. But kind of as a send-up of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So contrary to the image of the intense, sort of furious young man that's often written about in such romantic terms by rock critics, we were having a joke at the expense of all that imagery. And people fail to see the gag, you know, obviously, because it you're frozen there for a moment, and it came to represent something else, because the music obviously wasn't humorous like that. It was aggressive, you know.
Was there anything liberating for you about having a persona so that did it help at all in pouring out your emotions, because there was something actorly about it as well?
No, because I mean I'd learned through a harsh apprenticeship, which I'm sure everybody, I'm not saying it was any harder for me, you know. I toughened up my voice. I knew how to sing very loud, because I'd had to shut people up in clubs when I was playing solo. I played in bands. and all the sort of things, the way you learn. Now, I mean, a lot of people these days might get plucked out of obscurity at 19 and turned into some sort of sensation for 15 minutes and then thrown back outside again. So I count myself as rather lucky that that didn't happen, because obviously I had still a lot to learn. You know.
Right from the start, there was something really different about the songs that you were writing and the lyrics you were writing. And I think back to your early, one of your early songs, like Mystery Dance. There's a long history in rhythm and blues and rock and roll of people writing songs bragging about their sexual prowess. And then you come up with a song about someone who doesn't know how to do it.
Well, you know, I think there should be. I'm still doing this, fulfilling this role as I see it. You know, I'm not do it. You can't do it too consciously, because it's like being contrary. You know, but I do think there should be songs to sing for the people, you know, that don't have a voice. You know, there's plenty of songs that represent the other people. So once in a while, it's so easy to fall into the pattern. I thought, it isn't like saying, well, that's really me all the time. In the same way now, you know, you might sing a song that might express one point of view, which you're moved to write about that.
My guest is Elvis Costello, and you've brought a guitar with you. Would it be okay for me to ask you to sing a song?
Sure. I'll get out this guitar here. Sing this song I wrote in Greenland. Can I sing a song I wrote?
Sure, yeah.
This is a first on public radio. Here we go. Song written in Greenland, 500 miles above the Arctic Circle, in a place called Uminak. I was on holiday up there. And, you know, all they have up there is huskies and big blue icebergs and the few surviving large mammals in the sea, you know. And you know when they tell children that Santa Claus lives at the North Pole, you know? I started to think maybe God lived at the North Pole. When you look down the world at what we laughingly call civilization, these thoughts came to mind, and I made up this little story about this comedian who dies and goes to heaven and has to face his maker. Now, of course, he's made a career out of playing a drunk on stage. Do you remember those drunk acts they used to have?
Yep.
Only this guy plays a drunk priest. So, being as he's been making fun of God's mercenaries on earth, he's more than a little nervous. I wish you'd known me when I was alive. I was a funny fella. The crowd would hoot and holler for more. I wore a drunk's red nose for applause. Oh yes, I was a comical priest with a joke for the flock and a hand up your fleece, drooling the drink and the lipstick and grease paint down the cardboard front of my dirty dog collar. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And I'm going on to meet my reward. I was scared, I was scared, I was scared, I was scared. He might have never heard God's comic. So there he was, on a waterbed, drinking a cola of a mystery brand, reading an airport novelette, listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem. He said before it had really begun, I prefer the one about my son. I've been wading through all of this unbelievable junk and wondering if I should have given the world to the monkeys. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? He might have never heard that God.
God's comic. I'm gonna take a little trip down paradise's endless shores. They say that travel broadens the mind till you can't get your head out of doors. I'm sitting here on the top of the world. I hang around in the darkest night until each beast has gone to bed. And then I say, God bless, and put out the light. While you lie in the dark, afraid to breathe, you beg and you promise, and you bargain and you plead. Sometimes you confuse me with Santa Claus. It's the big white beard, I suppose. I'm going up to the pole where you folks die of cold. I might be gone for a while if you need me. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead. And you're all going on to meet your reward. Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? Are you scared? You might have never heard, but God's coming.
You said that you thought there was just a lot of dishonesty in most pop lyrics.
Well, there still is. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things made, a lot of small things made very large, you know, and there's a lot of talk about love, you know, but there isn't a lot of it evident. You know, there's a lot of, the word love is used a lot in songs, but I don't hear a lot of it in the subject matter, and it's not in the imagery with which the songs are presented.
Do you think that there's a kind of lyric that's become bankrupt, that it's difficult to write or sing anymore?
Well, no, because whenever you just get that impression, somebody will come up and write a beautiful love song that uses all the, you know, the 18 words it takes to write a love song and really turn it on its head, you know? I mean, there's a song on the new album that my wife Cot wrote that I think is... If I'd written the words, I might have been looking for, like, new words to describe those things. And sometimes you can kind of lead yourself down a blind alley by doing that, because you get afraid to use the simple words that everybody recognizes, because they have been so overused and all the mannerisms and everything. Can I play a little bit of this song?
Oh, sure, yeah. This is Baby Plays Around.
See, I wrote this song, I'll just play a verse of it. This is a song Chet Baker just did before he died, and I wrote it with him in mind, funnily enough, and this is about the fifth time this has happened to me now. I write songs with no way of ever knowing whether the song's going to reach these people, and suddenly they pick it up. It happened with Dusty Springfield. It happened with Johnny Cash. It happened with George Jones. It happened with Roy Orbison. And now it's happened again. So I wrote this song. So this is an example, really, of what I'm saying. This is a little verse from a song called Almost Blue. You know?
Almost blue. Almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here and she's almost you. Almost all the things that your eyes once promised, I see in hers too. Now your eyes are red from crying. Almost blue.
See, so that song is it's fine in its own way, but it's already gets into like a lot of sort of goes a little round the houses a bit, you know. It's pretty enough, but then there's this other song which I think is kind of a better song. So also I might remember all the chords of this one.
It's not open to discussion anymore. She's out again tonight, and I'm alone once more. She's all I have worth waiting for. But baby plays around, and so it seems I've always been the last to know. To hold on to that girl, I had to let her go. I wish to God I didn't love her so. 'Cause baby plays around. I try to be strong, hold on to my pride. She doesn't even know it's wrong, how much I hurt inside. And heaven knows I've tried, but baby plays around just a plaything. It's hard to reconcile the facts I'm facing. It's not open to discussion anymore. She walks those shiny streets, I walk the worn-out floor. She's all I have worth living for. But baby plays, baby plays.
That song's on your new record.
It's on the new record, yeah. And I mean, I went out to buy a paper, and when I got back, Cod had written that and sung it into the tape recorder. See, but it has simpler the language, and it's just the job was just to find out, you know, how to say it very plainly. And I mean, on the record, it's not a lot different to the way I played it then. There's a couple more instruments playing, but very softly. And, you know, you learn a little as you go on from listening to other things. And obviously, you start off with a model or something that might be in your head. In the case of that Almost Blue song, it was, you know, a little bit after a song called The Thrill Is Gone, and a little bit after the song Gloomy Sunday, you know, the same. I wanted to create the same sort of mood. Now, that's a big task, so maybe I hadn't really learnt quite enough, and although I'm proud of the song and I'm delighted that Chet Baker did a version on it, I still think, as a singer and everything, I had to learn a little bit more. And, you know, really, sometimes somebody coming straight into it and just sort of like seeing exactly what they want to say, without all this stuff, you know, that you have to go through, maybe can write a song like that. And my job was just to put the chords behind the melody.
One last question. A lot of your early records were about anger and frustration, and then your songwriting really opened up to encompass all kinds of different subjects and different emotions. I was wondering if that reflected an emotional change in you, just a broadening of your music, or, you know, if you had lost any of that anger, if that was just one part of your music that we were seeing then.
Well, like I said, I made a conscious decision that I was going to leave certain things out. There are many more feelings than even, you know, 15 albums worth of songs can express. You know, we're human beings. We have to be pegged to one. You know, when people kind of go, I was in France recently, you know, and they interviewed me, and they had this very kind of limited view of from 1977 of who I was and what I was about, and they said, "So how does it feel to be Mr. 8? And I said, "What?" I said, "Is it true that you ate French people?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry to make a joke with you, but I spat them out and did it my way."
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Elvis Costello speaking to Terry Gross in 1989. His 1977 introductory album, My Aim Is True, was re-released this week in an expanded 2-CD 30th anniversary edition.